Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. And on this week's show, the end has come for Mad Men after 7 seasons. So we'll talk about Don Draper, Peggy Olson, how it ended, and how we felt about how it ended. Then, by the time you hear this, we'll have seen the last of David Letterman's late-night shows. So we'll talk about his legacy and some of our own memories as he prepares for the handoff to Stephen Colbert. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So don't go away.
Hey, if you enjoy Pop Culture Happy Hour, you'll also love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how gyms trick us into never showing up, or why there are so few women programmers, plus other useful stuff like how to steal 1 million barrels of oil. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.
It's all about highly anticipated endings this week, but before we begin, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Directly to my right, Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead correspondent for NPR's Code Switch.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us out, appropriately enough for this Mad Men episode, joining us from sunny California.
On a cliffside.
On a cliffside.
Clinging.
Saying om.
with a small knowing smile.
Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor in charge of many things at Weekend Edition. I just gave myself a promotion.
That's why.
But that's what I do.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Thanks. Appreciate that.
So we are going to talk about the end of Mad Men. Now, look, if you are listening to this and you still intend to one day watch Mad Men and you haven't seen the final episode, this is not the segment for you. There is absolutely no way to do this segment and say, but we won't spoil anything. It's going to be spoiled. So what I'm saying is go forwards the usual amount into the second segment. You'll be fine. So Sunday night's Mad Men season 7 ended on a note that I think has been somewhat controversial because people were not 100% sure what to make of it in terms of the Don Draper story. Now, if you have been keeping up, you know, ad man Don Draper has been on a little bit of a walkabout, we might say, for the last few episodes, wound up in California on what I was corrected is not a hippie commune, but a retreat.
Right.
I had my hippie lingo incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
It was a retreat, but he was still with hippies.
They were hippies.
Yeah.
They were still hippies, and they were meditating, and they were holding seminars, and it was all very touchy-feely, and no one else from the show was there, which is what I always don't like, is when he's separated from everyone. But anyway, so he's out in California, and he winds up in a meditation session where he's saying, and then you zone out on the little ding of the meditation bell, right? Ding! And then you hear the Coke commercial from 1971, the I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing.
Which we're all going to do in chorus now.
Which
we're not. We're not, sorry.
Which you may know has a bunch of hippies standing on a mountaintop. And previously in the episode, Peggy had asked Don on the phone, don't you want to work on Coke, when she was trying to get him to come back to the agency. So the assumption was, and I believe the real McCann Erickson, which is a real company, created that ad.
They did.
The implication of the show, I felt, was that Don, who got a knowing smile while he was oming with all the hippies, took the inspiration of the hippies, went back, and started selling Coca-Cola with the hippies' inspiration rather than having an actual personal journey. There are others who believe they did not necessarily imply that. Perhaps Peggy made up the ad. I do not understand that.
Is there another possible interpretation for that last moment? I mean,
didn't our friend Mr. Sepinwall, I mean, he didn't say that maybe Peggy wrote it, but he said that maybe there was a possibility that it wasn't that Don wrote it, but that he was having the authentic experience of what that ad conjured.
Right. And that's...
You can imagine.
Well, that was my first takeaway from it, and I didn't get it, because as the show was careering toward its finale, those final moments on the cliffside, I got a cold sweat, because several of the shows that I love, and I don't want to talk about the Lost finale again, but let's talk about the Lost finale one last time, kind of glommed onto spirituality in their very final moments. Lost did it. Battlestar Galactica did it in a way that didn't stick the dismount for me, that really felt like this contract I had with the show was being voided because it's not the show that I thought I was watching. I thought I was getting that, and that's what I thought that moment with Don on the hillside was. He's having this a real moment, And then this other thing, we'll look at what the industry was doing with this real moment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. What I like is, since this show is about him wanting to change, never changing, wanting to change, never changing, wanting to change, never changing, the thing that's left ambiguous is exactly how much he's changed. He can still go back and have had a real experience, though those didn't really strike me as real experiences there because I'm a cynical jerk. But he can still go back and go on with his life and create this iconic ad. And the degree to which he's changed is what's left to us to interpret. I dug that.
I mean, it seems like wanting to change and never changing thing is part of what made this last season so sort of excruciating because... Mm-hmm. Don has this life in which he had a bunch of problems. And I mean, the central tension of his story in the early seasons was he took someone else's identity, right?
Right, sure.
But every time someone found out that he had this assumed identity, there were like no repercussions for it, except for that like one bravura scene in season three when Betty finds out, which was amazing. That was an amazing scene.
Yeah.
But outside of that, like everyone was like, oh, okay, whatever.
Right, sure.
Still looks so handsome.
Absolutely.
I don't care what your name
and
is.
And he kept living his life and kept getting richer. And it just kind of seemed like there would never be any consequences for it. And so really quickly, that stopped being an interesting thing for him to push back
on. He's a kind of very shallow person in a way who nevertheless is constantly having existential crises of various kinds.
Well, that's the weird thing about the show, right? When they pitch it, there was all this stuff about it. Like, you know, like, it's got all this mid-century modern design, and look, all these women and men are smoking and drinking and having
sex
in the office.
Look at the brassieres.
Yeah. Look at the brassieres. And that's what people talked about. That's the water cooler stuff people talked about for the first couple of years. It very quickly became apparent that at the core of this show is a very cold, chilly, existential dread. And that must have been a great pitch. It's Weltschmerz. With chain smoking.
More
Weltschmerz. Weltschmerz
and a great bra.
But what? My two passions. What the show has in common with its main character is this sense of withholding, of being inscrutable, and sometimes it works and sometimes it really, really doesn't. You know, this prestige television has a lot in common with what we call literary fiction, where it works on a level of plot. You know, it tells us a story, but what that story means is open to us. We have to invest more of ourselves than we do in a genre piece necessarily, because in genre pieces, dialogue is plot. Like, they're inextricably linked. That's how you get to the next scene. Somebody says, what's happening?
Right.
Here, people don't say what they mean. And sometimes because they're trying to mislead, sometimes because they have no idea what they mean or who they are, in the case of Don Draper. So that's interesting, but it can give you this sense that the show has a lot of gravitas, and sometimes that the show doesn't know what it's doing. It's just throwing a bunch of stuff out at us and saying, go.
One of the mistakes that people make with lots of shows like this is to assume that they're infallible and work backwards from there. If we assume the show is infallible, then what brilliant thing is it doing that I didn't come up with? It's worth thinking about what might I have missed, certainly. But the assumption that they can never make a mistake, that they can never do anything wrong, is also one of these things that happens with prestige television and auteur theory and stuff like that. Barry, how did the finale work for you?
So I loved it. And, you know, I was thinking through the final scenes how much I would like to, unlike Glenn, how much I would like to go to that retreat. And part of the reason that I would like to go to that retreat is it seems to me that in many ways the ideas there were sort of quintessential 70s ideas that you could still be a jerk. You could be selfish, but as long you could sort of justify it if you were kind of looking in the eyes of your partner or your person leading the group and say, this is how I'm being honest about it.
Right.
And that to me I thought was actually very clever because it allowed Don Draper to change without changing at all, because that was kind of what the 70s were like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you got to sort of connect yourself to, it's just sort of like a super intensified, honest form of selfishness, which, you know, it was as though he finally like reified, like self-actualized into the most selfish person he could be.
No, it's
true. Which for me, I found totally worked.
Yeah.
And then I got all the other stuff I wanted.
Right.
Which was a rom-com.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was so relieved, you know, to see Joan. Like, I loved the moment where Joan, which happened so quickly that, like, in 20 seconds, she was just done with the sugar daddy.
And leisure suit guy. Leisure suit Larry.
Oh, my God. I was a little sad about losing the leisure suits, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But at least they got to do coke together, which was kind of fun to watch.
That was very weird to me. Like, she doesn't have enough problems. Don't get Joan on cocaine.
I know, but give her if any one character really deserved the coke, Joan's been raped. She's had to, like, sleep her way to the top. I mean, it's terrible.
It's true.
You know?
Right. And I am going to be the person who is here for the rom-com.
I knew you were going to do this.
And I'll tell you what. Okay, Okay, first reason why is that I do not believe in denying yourself your authentic reaction. And when I was watching this unfold, I was on my couch at home, and I literally started clapping my hands saying, stand up, Peggy, stand up, Peggy, stand up, Peggy, because I am a trained SEAL in that way. Yeah, yeah. But from the standpoint of what Glenn was talking about, with the show being very chilly and withholding, there's something to be said for kind of opening that piece of, like, out of nowhere, there is an element of people just kind of being really happy.
Yes.
And it is not honest to present life as if it is all a series of miserable crises. It is not everybody has lung cancer and everybody is miserable and everybody is dealing with nothing but sexism all the time. I mean, it's there are also moments in which people are happy. And so to me, the fact that they included what I thought was really the only unambiguously happy ending for me, for those people, it made a lot of sense. And it was true in a way to her, because it is not fair, I don't think, to deny that as much as Peggy has worked incredibly hard in her job, she has also really wanted to meet someone. And she has tried to form relationships with guys. And she has over and over found that they're not supportive of her career, or they are just kind of jerks. And so to me, like, Stan kind of started off as a jerk.
He sucked at the beginning.
Yeah, he was horrible.
Fully sucked.
Still kind of a jerk.
He is not a jerk. Yeah. Stop that right now. So, but the fact that he did start off as a jerk, but yet they became very, very close and they developed this kind of emotional intimacy, I felt like that makes sense to me, that she would pick someone who's into the fact that she's so good at her job, who specifically is into that.
Well, Linda, you made a really good point in your post today about how she's disengaging from the Don relationship in a way, this where she's just been pouring her soul. It's not reciprocal. He is too selfish for not.
She dumped him.
It's not romantically. It's it's just this relationship that exists between these two people for something that is going to be a little bit more equal. The reason I shied away from it is not that Peggy can't be happy, and not that she can't be happy with Stan, although Stan's, she can do better than Stan.
Come on.
I like Stan.
I love Stan.
It's the it's the structure of the way it was handled.
That's
with that Rock Hudson Doris Day banter back and forth, that you just kept waiting for Tony Randall to flounce in at any moment.
It's because
they're on the phone. Everybody's on the phone. Gene talked to hear you saying furious cosigns. Back up, Glenn. It's fine.
It felt so tonally inconsistent with everything. I mean, so few things in the show are that effusive. And like, she's like, oh my God, I think I'm in love with you too. It was like Clueless when the fountain comes on. She's like, oh my God, I love
exactly
Josh.
Like Clueless when the fountain comes on. That was so great.
It was just too much.
One happy moment.
I'm with you.
One more thing. If you ever in your life said that January Jones can't act, that scene between her and Don on the phone was a giant heaping helping of bite me.
Because she was awesome.
She was so good.
She was great.
And now we see that this is what she's playing. And if you watch Last Man on Earth, you can see she's playing something very different there.
She's also in a current movie with Ethan Hawke called Good Kill, where she's a military wife.
Yeah.
And she's very good in that, too.
Yeah, I was always very much in the camp, like, is Betty Draper supposed to be vacant and vapid, or is January Jones?
This is on purpose. And she had a couple of really bad film roles, the X-Men thing,
and all this
other stuff. But for me, there's always been something that is compelling about that character. As sad as it is to say, like, I'm really glad she got cancer. Like, but from a standpoint of the show and the character, I think it was interesting that they gave that family that story so that you had that scene. She was so sensible. It was as if this lifetime of training to be a kind of proper person had, in this weird way, prepared her for this experience of, you know, there were people who talked about her letter to Sally, which is a lot of it is about how she wants to look and things like that, as being kind of, you know, after all this time, she's still kind of vain and values herself for her beauty or whatever. But there are a lot of people who care about things like how their funeral is and how their death is perceived, and also don't want other people to have to think about it. She is also making sure Henry and Sally and other people don't have to sit there and think, what would Mom have wanted to wear? Because they would know it was important to her. And if she just says, do this, do this, do this, other people don't have to think about it. Yeah. And in that way, it's a kindness. But I think, as you said, that conversation between Don and Betty, when she has that wonderful moment where you can tell that she just wants to kind of accept this love from him. She kind of wants to I recently went back and watched some of the early episodes, and I mentioned this in the post that I wrote today, but if you go back and watch the early episodes, they really loved each other, had a lot of happy times together, and were hot for each other, and had, in some ways, a good marriage, despite the fact that he was always a cheater,
right?
That he was lying to her in so many ways. They did love each other, and it's false to make that into something where it was like, well, you know, his icy wife was the reason he was cheating. Like, that's not it.
No,
that was
no.
never what it was.
After she initially marries Henry, like, as time goes on, mm-hmm. and you see Don and her in the same room, mm-hmm. you see that sort of, like, you can see why they liked each other. Or,
yeah.
I mean, they sort of have this chemistry.
Really,
they
chemistry.
Do. They really do. Mm-hmm. They really
like
do.
The twinkle, which is why his, like, knock him dead birdie is, like,
yeah, that was great.
Such a killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then, of course, and it also, that story also opened up that couple of scenes for Kieran and Shipka, who they cast to play Sally when she was
right.
probably, what, like 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
maybe
right.
7 years old.
And she's the best character on the show.
And right. she's totally. Absolutely wonderful. And she's so self-possessed. Mm. And you can certainly, there are kids who have been cast at that age. You can go back and look at when they were casting Tina Majorino at that age and Mae Whitman mm-hmm. at that age. You can see things in kids at mm-hmm. that age. But you're still incredibly lucky if you wind up with an older teenager to whom you can give a conversation like the one Sally has with Don, where she says, listen to me, take me seriously, care about your kids enough not to expect everybody to come and live with you. That is not realistic. Mm-hmm. Tell her to leave them with Henry.
The other moment for Kieran and Shipka in that episode is the one with Bobby.
Yes.
Where
mm-hmm.
she becomes the best version of Betty. Mm-hmm. She manages to get all of the sensibility, all of the sort of sensible get-her-done-erness of Betty mm-hmm. in such a lovely way. And then so that it gave even more weight to that last scene in the montage of her washing the dishes while Betty reads and smokes.
Yeah.
And I loved the pile of books on Betty's table. You know, mm-hmm. it gave that feeling of that she was still going down the road of, like, even though she knew the road was shorter. I found that storyline genuinely moving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kudos.
Well, the scene last in the previous episode in which we found out that she had mm-hmm. had lung cancer in a very short time, according mm-hmm. to her doctor. And Henry was sort of saying, because she had her books mm-hmm. and she was getting ready to go to class.
What are you doing? Yeah.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And she said, why was I ever doing it?
Right.
She doesn't understand. She's trying to live normally as long as she can.
Right.
And I think,
and she's still trying to become herself.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Who she maybe never had, because there just weren't a lot of choices for women,
right.
as we saw in every other storyline.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think one of the most perhaps moving moments in that entire episode is her saying to Don, I want things to be normal, and you not being here is part
that's
of that.
Part of it. Like, and it wasn't a dig.
It's not a dig.
It was not unkindness.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
And that's why that's where he starts to cry, is mm-hmm. because he realizes that she is right. Mm-hmm. He has left. Mm-hmm. He has not been a presence. He has done a bunch of terrible things. As he later tells Peggy mm-hmm. on the phone, he starts to rattle off his sins. I scandalized my child. I broke mm-hmm. all my mm-hmm. vows. He's been thinking about all these things that he did that he shouldn't have done. I was mostly satisfied by it, even
Me
though
too.
I thought the Coke commercial thing at the end was a little bit like, guess what? Like,
yeah.
a little cute.
Yeah, it was a little cute, but it worked for me.
Yeah, me too.
And it's very telling, though, I think, that we spent all this time talking about all the women characters, right? We have mm-hmm. not touched, I mean, because all the interesting stuff was happening with them.
It it's true.
For the
yeah,
last
no,
season
I did, I can't believe I didn't even mention Pete.
Yeah.
Oh, Campbell. Yeah. I was
and his,
so happy.
And his rom-com.
I was so happy he got together with Trudy. It's really funny. We got like 5 episodes from the end, and I told somebody, I was like, I still ship Pete and Trudy. I didn't really expect it to pay off.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I didn't expect to get that thing where, like, he seemed to suddenly realize, like, oh, my God, I'm going to be a sweaty old man. Wait.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God, Pete and Peggy.
Yes.
The cactus goodbye.
Yeah.
Wept.
Good
I love they don't even touch. The allusion to whatever their past was... So I
and there's
loved
no
that.
Rancor. There's no.
And when she said a thing like that, I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah,
and he's the part. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, he spent so much time being competitive with Don mm-hmm. and trying to kind of catch up with Don. And he mm-hmm. was the one who really gave her, which was that comment of like, someday people are going to brag that they worked with you.
Yep.
Yeah. And no one will ever do that for me.
And then that admission, that admission when she mm-hmm. says, you know, I don't know what to say to that or whatever. And he kind of says, well, no one's ever said it to me.
Yeah.
It's not bitter. It's because he knows it's not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's okay with the fact that it's not true.
Yes.
You know?
No, it's true.
I did, you know, and the more we talk about it, the more I realize, like, I really liked a lot of things about it.
Yep.
I just wasn't crazy about the little thing at the end seemed a little bit mm-hmm. twee to me, mm-hmm. to be honest.
I was also, by the way, I have to say, glad that I was, you know, that all the people I wanted to have a great final moment
mm-hmm.
did. Like, I didn't care that the last time we saw Harry, he was, like, stomping out being Harry.
That's so funny.
I love
Rich Summer so much, and mm-hmm. in a way, I wish that had, like, blossomed into this great character who had a great closing story.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he was just there to kind of be a gross dude in the last couple seasons kind of was useful to the show.
Yeah. Really.
I felt for him.
Right. He's like what Stan could have not...
Exactly.
Stan had not turned into. Like, not everybody was a Stan.
Oh,
but God, that that hair.
I am so into Stan. I don't even...
Too. I feel like I know exactly what it would be like to hug him.
I know. I mean, hug. Now I'm distracted. Now I'm distracted by thinking about hugging Stan. Anyway. All right. So I will be very curious. I know that all of you have read plenty about Mad Men or talked plenty about Mad Men, but I am curious to hear what you all thought of the finale. So come and find us on Facebook or on Twitter at NPRPCHH and tell us what you thought. When we come back, we're going to go from one ending to another and talk a little bit about David Letterman. So stick around.
Hi, I'm Sarah Dixon, and I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. Pop Culture Happy Hour is supported by Squarespace, providing online tools for individuals and businesses to create a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, domains, e-commerce, and more. Squarespace enables people to share their story online in a way that reflects who they are and what they're all about. Visit squarespace.com/popculture for more information and a free trial.
Welcome back. As you know, we just got done talking about Mad Men. That's one big ending. And another big ending that happened this week is the end of David Letterman's late night show. He has been in late night since, what, 1982?
Mm-hmm.
82, I believe.
Yep.
Before that, had a daytime show. And
he did.
But he's hanging it up and he's turning the show over to Stephen Colbert. I'm going to start with Glenn because Glenn does a lot of stuff around comedy for us. Are you a Letterman guy, Glenn, or no?
Hugely so.
Yeah.
So at least in the beginning. Before we begin, we should say that everything we think we know about David Letterman, the David Letterman approach, his sensibility, his voice.
This is in my notes. I know exactly what you're going to say.
50% Meryl Marco.
Yep. This is exactly what's in my notes.
Meryl Marco was his head writer on his daytime show, and at least in the beginning on late night. Everything that we know, the stupid pet tricks, the small town news, all that stuff.
The remotes.
All that stuff. And if you want to know more about her and exactly how much she did, he's admitted this as well, you should listen to the Julie Klausner interview on How Was Your Week when she interviewed Meryl Marco. I watched his daytime talk show. It was the weirdest thing. It was there in the middle. It came on, replaced High Rollers and Card Sharks.
Card Sharks.
Right.
Wow.
And it's just in the middle.
Tattletales.
And it was. There were like cooking segments and fashion segments. Mm-hmm. It was this weird daytime talk show amid, you know, this really bland sea of normalcy.
Right.
It was this bit of absurdism. Like if Mad Men is existentialism, Letterman is like this constant dose of absurdism in the middle of television. And he had this rotating stable of writers and guests who would come on as different characters. So he had Rich Hall. He had Valerie Bromfield. He had Edie McClurg. The great Edie McClurg.
Really?
Was on that show. And she would come on repeatedly as a housewife. And she would do her voice of Grace from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh.
And she would she was a housewife who had lived outside of every major city in the United States. And she would go down the list every time. And every time she would get to Conshohocken, I would just get a little thrill. It was so weird. But in college is where I sort of internalized him.
Mm-hmm.
We watched it every night. I wanted to be him. I don't mean I wanted to be a talk show host. I wanted to be him. I internalized things like his speech patterns, his approach. I read everything I could get my hands on about the guy.
Mm-hmm.
The longest and hardest I've ever laughed in my life, there was a segment he did called Thrift Shop Finds, where he would pull something out of a box on the below the desk and put it up on the desk and let the camera take it and say a little thing. And this one time, he took out a cowrie shell. Now, you guys know what a cowrie shell is?
Yep.
It's a sort of football-shaped, and it's got a ridge on the bottom that is toothed.
Oh, yeah, 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 okay.
Right? And he drops it on. He's kind of pushing it back and pushing it back. And the audience is like, no, 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 do it, do it. And he's like, okay, okay. And he puts it down, lets the camera zoom in, and it's the cowrie shell with two giant googly eyes and this enormous red pair of lips on it. And he says, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Lucille Ball. And he takes it off and goes, no, 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 no. And I couldn't stop laughing. That is the longest and hardest I've ever laughed and ever will laugh. I know that about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that? See, he was the answer to the schmaltzy, sentimental, fake sincerity that was kind of gripping show business at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it was mean, but he also, the reason he did it was because at this time, Lucille Ball was going around a lot of talk shows and crapping on everything because she was an old lady in her polyester pantsuit and she hated everything and felt that she knew what comedy was and nobody was giving her her due. So that was like a little zing that I don't know why. Still to this day, I don't know why it was so funny. But yes, so
you were a Letterman guy.
Short answer, yes.
Yeah. How about you, Gene? Were you a Letterman guy? You're a little bit younger than Glenn.
I think I may have, probably in elementary school when he was the height of his powers. Mm-hmm. I guess in the early 90s when there was the big fight between him
and Leno over Johnny Carson's job.
And I was just, you know, it was just inertia. I would watch ER and then I would watch whatever came on after that. So I never made the jump over to CBS with him. Yeah, I was never like a huge Letterman fan. Although his comedy was infinitely superior to Jay Leno's comedy. It was like all the stuff that, the pop cultural stuff that you pick up, sort of Simpsons and all this other stuff like that, was much more
aligned with him.
Right,
than,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yet, then inertia of TV.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this is a guy who really kind of came to prominence with a 12:30 show at a time when people had VCRs, some people, but it was certainly before the DVR and before YouTube and all that stuff. So for the most part, make it a 12:30 show for people who are up at 12:30, which I think one of the things that he discovered, and one of the things I remember valuing about that show a lot, was that it did have this feeling of like no one's watching. Yeah. So who cares? And you know, television at that time had this feeling of like everything being broad, right? Because either kind of before cable or just the very beginning of the idea of cable, you still were mostly trying to get large audiences in theory on broadcast television at all times. But here came 12:30 and it's like, well, look, who's watching? People who are up at 12:30. And so what I loved about it was so weird. And the weirdness of it was intentional. The weirdness of it didn't mean it was bad. It just meant it was weird. I remember my sister and I had on a VCR tape for a really long time an episode of Letterman that I don't remember why we had this one. But it had Zippy the Chimp, who at one point was skateboarding around the studio. And there's a moment when he's talking to the camera. He's just doing the show. And Zippy just goes by. And then he looks at the camera and he says, "It's really funny. Something's definitely wrong with me. I thought I just saw a monkey go by on a skateboard." And that's the kind of thing that I thought was so funny because it was so weird. And it was so unexpected. How about you, Barry? Letterman person?
Well, so my problem is a little bit that I'm not a late night person. Anyone who knows me knows I go to bed at 9:15, and back in the day, I would be out at 12:30. So it was, I missed him in a lot of ways.
You went directly from being out to being asleep.
Literally. So yes, no, that is a terrible brag. But his brand of the sort of cranky, vinegary guy and weirdness, I love weirdness, definitely appeals to me. I think that my tastes now that, you know, now that the VCR and the DVR exist, now do run toward the more silly, cheery Fallon type thing because that's a little bit more my deal. But that said, there was an inner kindness to Letterman that I really appreciated. And so, you know, the couple of the moments that I remember with him was the Warren Zevon interview, who was dying and had been a frequent guest on the show. And it was like he treated him with such kindness, but it was also a really good interview.
There's a human in there.
Yeah. And that I really sort of appreciated about him. I will say, and I don't know, it's fine, you know, I know that this is maybe not the place for it as we somewhat eulogize him, but do you remember the Vanity Fair article from the female staffer about 2009 talking about, this was about around the time of the thing with the women.
Right. The thing, if you don't remember this story, he came on because he was sort of forced to, came on and talked about the fact
that he had
been blackmailed, or this is the story that he told, was that he had been blackmailed by somebody who was threatening to reveal that he had had an affair. Not only he was married and was having multiple affairs with women who worked on his show, which he came on television and said, "I was being blackmailed because someone was threatening to reveal this, and it is true."
And now, that was mighty shrewd of him, and I appreciated that. But I will also say this article by a woman who's, I can't remember now, who wrote it, described an atmosphere that it really left a bad taste in my mouth. And that there was a shrewdness to him doing it, which was the right thing to do, but it did tarnish him for me.
I don't think there's any question that he is a dude with a lot of layers, not all of which I would find at all pleasant. I think what you're
that
identifying...
That particular layer is a tough one for
me. Yeah, and I think what you're... Right, and I don't mean to minimize it at all.
I
don't know... Without being there, it's really hard to kind of evaluate where to put that. And also because I never know, like, how many people are like that when, you know, when you don't see them. So it's complicated to kind of put that in the context of other things.
Right.
He has always had a weakness for kind of flirtatious relationships with pretty actresses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I think you can choose to either find cute
creepy or not,
or you can find it kind of condescending or and creepy.
Creepy uncle.
Yeah, creepy uncle-y. Mm-hmm. And I haven't yet seen it. There is an Amy Schumer bit that's been going around. Did you see that, Jane?
Yeah, and she's like a ditzy ingenue. And
she's doing like,
I don't know how to sit down. Yeah. Look at my little dress. Yeah.
And I have seen speculation that is aimed at him primarily.
Exactly what I thought it was. I thought of like the Drew Barrymore stuff.
Yes.
He changed. The guy that I admired the hell out of and wanted to be was the guy on NBC at 12:30.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because looking back over old clips, what I noticed, what struck me all the time, is how often he was just sitting there smiling. He was having a great time.
Yeah.
So this clip is him with a guy by the name of Brother Theodore. You should Google this guy. This guy lived a life. But at this point in his life, he had an off-Broadway show where he would get on stage and rant in much the way that he will rant here. And the word he says at the end, because it doesn't make any sense, is Theodorize. He wants to Theodorize the world. But let's hear this clip.
With every failure, David, with every failure, my reputation grows. One of these days, you will see my picture on every postage stamp. One of these days, I'll Theodorize the world.
Is that a Banlon shirt?
So that's it, right? He would puncture whatever you come to him with. If you're popped up with anything, if self-regard or anger or anything, he would puncture it. That's what he does.
Mm-hmm.
He changed, though. When he moved from 12:30 on NBC to 11:30 on CBS, I noticed a big change. The absurdity was less because he was playing to a wider audience, and he got crankier. If you watch that clip, he's beaming through the whole thing because he just is totally confused by this guy. And because I don't watch late-night talk shows anymore, because I don't care what the third lead from JAG experienced on their Mexican vacation, I really lost touch with him. I've really lost touch with him. And so, you know, now when I go back and I see all these encomiums, like the Norm Macdonald one we should talk about was amazing, these clips from the NBC show probably aren't going to be getting a lot of play because that's from, you know, another part of his life and legally blah, blah, blah. And what we're seeing a lot of is this stuff from this new show, which I just never really connected with.
Yeah. What I remember that I really, really loved that he did on the NBC show was all the stuff that was just the weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
kind of like, people have talked a lot recently about the Larry Bud Melman stuff that he did, where he would send this old man, who they called Larry Bud Melman, although that was not his name. He would go out and he would interview people, and they swore, I was reading something about this just the other day, they swore that the habit he had of holding the microphone to the other person while he was talking and then to himself while the other person was talking was something they not only didn't write but couldn't have written.
Yep.
It's just something he did. But I also was remembering the other day, there was a guy, Rupert G. He ran Hello Deli.
Oh, sure.
And they would go visit Rupert G. at the Hello Deli. And I liked that. And then I always remember this segment that they did where they went to this store called Just Bulbs.
Oh, my God. Classic.
And it was light bulbs. And the whole store was just light bulbs. And then they said, they went to the guy who owned Just Bulbs or ran Just Bulbs and said, well, where in here can I buy a lampshade? And he said, you can't buy shade. Can't buy a lampshade? I guess you'd have to go to a store called Just Shades. And then the next thing you see is they're at a store called Just Shades.
Yep.
You can see, assuming this is all real, which I assume it was because it's New York and there's a store for everything. So David Letterman is handing off his show to Stephen Colbert. And before we get off this topic, I want to just quickly ask, Glenn, do you have any intention of watching Stephen Colbert's version of this show?
Certainly out of curiosity, but I can't imagine I'd stick with it just because it's that thing that it is. It's that talk show format just doesn't really hold a lot of interest to me. Colbert does. The format doesn't.
Right. And I have to admit, I saw Colbert interview George Lucas at the Tribeca Film Festival. And it seemed like a little bit of a dry run for kind of what it might be like to have him out of character interviewing celebrities. And I thought, he might be too nice.
Yeah.
Like, he's
interesting.
He just comes across like such a nice man, which is how he's always appeared every time I've seen him talk and whatever. You almost feel like he's just there trying to say the nicest possible thing to people at all times. Now, that could just be because it was George Lucas and he really loves Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. But that niceness works for, like, Jimmy Fallon, or to the extent
Absolutely.
That it works at all, right?
Absolutely. But I feel like it's almost not that manic niceness. Mm-hmm. It's just it's like watching the nicest person you know interview people, which I don't know whether I don't. It's an interesting phenomenon, I thought. I don't know. You going to watch the Colbert version, Barry?
Well, I love, yeah. I mean, now I'm really curious. I wouldn't have guessed that he would have been the nicest person you know interviewing. I don't know why I think
like
that.
Oh, he seems like the nicest man. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I don't. But yeah, I will, because I find him interesting. And again, I'll watch it at, you know, 7:30 p.m. the next day.
Right, exactly.
I mean, there's so many of those shows. They're all essentially interchangeable. The celebrities don't need them anymore. I mean, like, everything about it seems dated and...
No. That's true.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Yep. I think a lot of people go directly to their own public on Instagram and Twitter mm-hmm. and all that stuff when they want to promote their stuff.
And even the bits that are, like, anymore. You know, the sort of funny, like, mm-hmm. scripted bits, like, those end up on the internet, like, shout out into the blogosphere or the Twitterverse anyway. So, like, you see the clip of YouTube busking in the New York City subway.
Yeah.
Or you see, you know, the Roots playing on kids' instruments. Those things all end up in the universe anyway. Like, you don't need to watch the shows. It's just...
Right. And John Oliver has created the show, has formatted mm-hmm. the show so that those bits, you can take them out mm-hmm. and you can mm-hmm. show them up on, slap them up on YouTube and get lots and lots of hits.
And they still have substance to them and all that stuff. And I was going to say, too, you know, you mentioned that the Fallon stuff is kind of more upbeat and this kind of joyful participatory thing. And I think part of what happened with Letterman is that show had a darkness to it, partly because the rest of television was so sunny. Mm-hmm. And I have a theory that Jimmy Fallon's show is so joyful, partly because the rest of television is so dark and arch uh-huh. now. Mm-hmm. So much of what people watch and talk about is that it's kind of this, like, joy revival.
It's a balloon,
Because the rest of television is a lot of watching people get killed if you watch a lot of TV.
Right.
All right. Well, on that on that cheerful note, when we come back, we will be going into our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back with us.
This is Nick from Port St. Lucie, Florida. And this episode and the following message are made possible by PicMonkey.com, an online photo editor that is super sorry for being a promotional message right now. What they want to be is your favorite photo editor. Whether you're editing photos or creating collages, you'll be having fun and making cool stuff. And now you, yes you, can have a free month of PicMonkey's premium subscription. It's a heaping mega spoon of bonus features, and it costs money for everybody except you. Just go to picmonkey.com/pop.
Okay, welcome back. You know what time it is. It is our final segment. It is time to talk about what is making us happy this week. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
This week, I'm going to choose a book. I don't always choose a book, but this
book.
Week it is a book. I know, but I do want to make sure to all the people that care about the other stuff I care about, I really am loving Southern Charm and The Real Housewives of New York City. It's by Matt Johnson, and it's called Loving Day. I'm going to bring this back around to Mad Men a little bit, which is that one of the things I love about Mad Men and the way that those characters are drawn is that so much of the series is about being afraid that you will be identified in the way that others see you as opposed to the way that you see yourself. This book is about Warren Duffy, who's having a comic book illustrator. It's a little bit autobiographical because so is Matt Johnson. And he's, you know, coming off of a bitter divorce, and he moves back to his hometown after he receives his father gives him a dilapidated mansion in the city. And in the span of a moment at a comic book convention, he meets two people who change his life. I kind of can't say more without spoiling some major stuff here, but Warren is biracial. His mother is black. His father is Irish. And that's sort of a central part of his existence. And that fear of how he is categorized is one of, I think, the most interesting things I've ever read in a novel. And I think it applies to anybody who's a human and identifies them as anything, whether it's your race or your gender or whatever. 10 pages into it, I didn't want to stop reading it. And I really, and I'm a fast reader, this one I really burned through and then was kind of mad that I did. So I highly recommend this to anybody that is interested in a piece of literary fiction that is also just a barrelingly fast, fascinating read.
All right.
It's Loving Day by Matt Johnson.
Thank you, Barry Hardiman. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
In keeping with, I guess, the theme of not being able to spoil anything, a piece of culture that you will spoil very easily, I would like to recommend About Ellie. It is a thriller by, I'm going to butcher this guy's name, Asghar Farhadi. It's in Farsi. It is his first film. It's the film that most people know him from is called A Separation, which is this devastating film. Mm-hmm. It's like a beautiful...
Oh, I love that film.
It's
a
great movie.
And he also made one called The Past that I really loved.
So about Ellie actually
was his
first movie. And I guess it got stuck in like production hell or distribution hell in the States.
Interesting.
And so it never came out. And so it just came out, I guess, in the last month or so in the States. And there's almost nothing I can say about it that will not be sort of spoilery. Mm-hmm. Although in the title, you can probably figure out who the bad thing happens to.
Oh, yeah.
There's this sort of upper class Iranian gaggle of friends. They're going out for like a weekend retreat. They find this sort of dilapidated beach house that they decided to like hunker down in for a weekend. And then a character who was very easy to figure out goes missing. And then all of these lies become unspooled and all these people become enmeshed in more lies as they try to fix the complications of this thing that they are in the center of. And that's really vague and not very helpful, but it is a fantastically acted movie. It is legitimately like edge of the seat, like what the hell is going on? It is a fantastic movie. Everyone is sort of indicted in the movie. But everyone is there. Everyone's responses to all the stuff that's happening is very plausible.
Yeah.
They seem very plausible. So I love this movie. I can't stop thinking about it. It's about Ellie.
Wonderful. Yeah. About Ellie. Thank you very much, Gene Demby. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two superpowered chicks. one new, one old. We saw the first trailer for Supergirl on CBS. Mm-hmm. And this proceeded to divide the internet in half because the tone of this is very bright, funny. The woman playing Supergirl is playing her kind of bumbling and just wanting to do good. You get some nerd bros who are like, why isn't it dark and gritty? Why can't it be all like, you know, like serious? Why is, what's this rom-com crap?
Sure.
And you know, and in fairness, you also get some women who are like, why she got to be ditzy? You know?
Yeah, no, that's fair.
You know, why is it basically Ellie McBeal? Get what I did there? Jor-El? Kal-El? It's basically that.
Wow. Yeah.
Nobody said that. Just me. Just me as the person saying that.
I thought that was a win.
No. But I am
then
really...
Then I like Fallon.
This is the tone that I want these shows to strike. And these special effects look really, really good. I am mm-hmm. in for this. The other one is an old one. Cozy TV, C-O-Z-I TV.
Wow.
Has been running The Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man in reruns for a long time. And when I first heard about that, I was like, so excited. And I loaded up my DVR. And then it's like 78, you know, $6 Million Mans, which is a lot of $6 Million Mans. Uh-huh. And it turns out that showrunners in 1977 had a very different understanding of pacing. And there's a lot of dead spots in these things. Oh, boy. Just people running around Ojai in slow motion forever. I deleted them all. And then I saw one just pops up because Cozy's schedule is kind of weird. It just doesn't do it regularly. So all of a sudden, one will pop up. And I was like, I should really delete that. I wonder which one it is. Okay, which one is it? And of course, it was Fembots in Las Vegas, a part two. Now, you hear that and you say, but Glenn.
You have to have seen part one.
Exactly. Happily, Linda Holmes, the title is the plot. The plot is the title. It's Jamie Summers in showgirl outfits and all these fembots with their faces falling off running around in matching different colored pantsuits. It's just great. And the joy of watching something that says, whenever you pause it, Fembots in Las Vegas Part 2 cannot be underestimated.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So that's The Bionic Woman on Cozy TV.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Okay, so making me happy this week, two quick things and then a real thing. First of all, I did finish The Girl on the Train.
Mm-hmm.
The very, very end is a few problems, but I enjoyed the book a lot. So that's one thing. Another thing is the season finale of Brooklyn Nine-Nine was this week. I happen to think that is an excellent finale. Mm-hmm. I think that show is super fantastic. I think it has a ton of things going for it. And I think if you watch that show and there's not somebody in that cast who just totally does it for you, then I will be very surprised because there's just a lot of different stuff going on in that show. I am officially, as we tape this, on vacation. On the first day of my vacation, this is what I did. Leap year, Sweet Home Alabama, 27 Dresses, The Wedding Planner, Runaway Bride, Bring It On, Speed, and Miss Congeniality.
Wow.
That was my day. Now that runs the gamut, right? Speed's a good movie.
From like A to B. But yes.
Well, no, I'm sorry. Yes.
To quote the great Dorothy Parker. But
absolutely. A to B genre-wise, although Speed is thrown in there. But A to Z quality-wise, to some degree. Because,
What's the Z?
Well, Bring It On is a really good movie.
Yeah.
Bring It On is a terrific movie.
Solid.
Speed's a terrific movie.
Terrific movie.
A lot of these other ones are perfectly fine movies of their type, mm-hmm. right? Sweet Home Alabama is a perfectly fine movie of its type. It's silly. the same thing is true of Miss Congeniality. Mm-hmm. And 27 Dresses, Barry, don't get me started. I like 27 Dresses. Shut up. Oh, Be quiet.
I mean, Barry I'll watch it when it's on the TV because I'm not a communist.
Don't pick on my day.
Sorry.
The Wedding Planner is not a good movie.
No.
Runaway Bride is a decent movie. Mm. I like that one. And Leap Year is not a good movie at all. But what Leap Year has going for it is that Matthew Good is in it. And every romantic comedy, ideally in Linda World, would have Matthew Good in it. Uh-huh. Because why not? I mean, now he's on Downton Abbey, if you haven't seen that. He also has been trying to get lucky over in The Good Wife for a long time, and I don't know why.
It's crazy that it's not happening. Because his last name both describes him and is his last name.
It just does not even make any sense. He is wonderful. The movie is not. But he is great. And so that was my joyful day of really just perfect movies for the first day of a vacation. Mm-hmm. I was entirely happy. I don't care what anyone thinks. I will debate Barry another time on 27
Dresses. No, next time I'll just sit on the couch with you.
We will debate 27 Dresses until the cows come home, as I'm sure they do at some point in that movie because everything else happens. Again, Marsden. Marsden is the reason that is a good movie.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay. Good cheekbones.
He is incredibly charming in that movie. All right. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Barry at B Hardyman, H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow Gene at G-D-215. That's G-E-E-D-E-E 215. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon. And our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening, and I will see you right back here next week.
NPR One is the new audio app that connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and now podcasts curated for you. Great storytelling and rigorous reporting that informs, engages, inspires, and surprises. Available whenever, wherever. Download NPR One from iTunes or Google Play. NPR One is public radio made personal.